going to continue reading today from the book, The One Thing Is Three by Father Michael Gately. And we are on page 226 as we read about personalism. Father Gately writes, he said that the first inside perspective is a philosophical one. Specifically, John Paul II calls it personalism. Noting it is difficult to formulate a systematic theory on how to relate to people. Yet Father Gately was greatly helped in this by the study of personalism during the years he devoted to philosophy. What is personalism? It's a philosophical approach to the human person from the perspective of his uniqueness and dignity. In the words of one of Father Gately's favorite philosophy professors, it involves a fascination with the fact that each person is unrepeatedly and incommunicably himself or herself, that is, each is not only an objective, but also a subjective being, that each lives out his or her interiority, that each is being of surpassing, indeed, infinite worth and dignity, that can each live and thrive only by existing with and for other persons. Father Gately wishes he had a time for a whole book-length crash course on personalism. Since it's such a rich and wonderful study, here we'll have to settle for a much shorter summary. Our guide into it will be none other than Pope John Paul II, Carol Watoya. The heart of John Paul's personalism was reflected in one of his favorite passages from the Second Vatican Council. Like his other favorite passage, it is only in the mystery of the Word made flesh that the mystery of man truly becomes clear. This one comes from Gaudium et Spes. Indeed, the Lord Jesus, when he prayed to the Father that all may be one, as we are one, from John 17:21 through 22, opened up vistas closed to human reason, for he implied a certain likeness between the union of the divine persons and the unity of God's Son in truth and charity. The likeness reveals that man, who is the only creature on earth which God willed for its own sake, can fully discover his true self only in a sincere giving of himself. See Luke 17:33.
Most everything that John Paul has to say about the human person, at least from a philosophical perspective, flows from this passage. Specifically, it's all in the last sentence, which contains two important points. One, man is the only creature on earth which God willed for its own sake. And two, man can fully discover his true self only in a sincere giving of himself. This polarity of what we call self-possession and self-donation tells us just about everything we need to know, philosophically speaking, about what it means to be a human person, about what it means to see man from the inside. We'll look at both of these poles in turn, starting with self-possession. Self-possession. Think about it for a moment. Man is the only creature willed for its own sake. Chemicals, minerals, plants, and animals are not willed for their own sakes. In fact, they're willed for man, and man can use them as objects for his enjoyment, growth, and good. There's nothing wrong with this. On the other hand, the human person himself should never be used as a mere object by anyone. Votia formulates this in what he calls the personalistic norm, which he states both negatively and positively. The norm, in its negative aspect, states that the person is the kind of good which does not admit of use and cannot be treated as an object of use, and as such, the means to an end. In its positive form, it confirms this, that the person is a good towards which the only proper and adequate attitude is love.
We'll consider the positive aspect of the norm in the second point. Self-donation. Here, we'll treat the negative aspect. Before we begin, however, it's interesting to note that Watoya goes to say that this norm defines and recommends a certain way of relating to God and to people, a certain attitude towards them. Fostering in ourselves this way of relating and this attitude, what John Paul II calls for contemplative outlook, is the central goal for this chapter. And the way we're going about fostering this way of relating, this attitude and outlook, is by meditating on the specific truth that, when it goes from our heads to our hearts, can best form it in us. Of course, Father Gately is talking about the truth of human dignity. Here specifically, let's continue our philosophical reflection on human dignity by turning our attention to the negative aspect of the personalistic norm, namely, that the human person cannot be treated as a mere object of use. Why shouldn't man be treated as a mere object? It's because while it's true that human beings are objects in the world, for instance, we can see them bodily from the outside. They are also subjects, meaning they have a whole inner conscious life. As Newman put it, man has his own center. He has that truly awe-evoking ability to say, I. This is a wonder of the wonders. Human beings, unlike animals, can be present to themselves. They are self-conscious. They all know this. But at the same time, self-consciousness is something so familiar to us, so close to us, that we often don't realize it. Father Gately is going to give us an example to help us realize it now. Father Gately writes, I'm typing these words on the computer. As I'm typing them, I'm also present to myself as the one typing them. I can see my hands working away on the keyboard. I'm looking at those hands on the keyboard, and I can say to myself, those are my hands. I stop typing, and I can feel my heart beating. I can say to myself, that is my heart. I feel beating in my chest. Yet, even if I'm not actually saying those are my hands and that is my heart, the self-awareness is still there, like someone looking over my shoulders as I act. It's always there to a greater or lesser degree. Who is that someone? It's me. It's me watching myself, me being present to myself, me acting with awareness of myself. Again, the self-awareness is so familiar that it may not seem like much of a wonder. We're used to it. After all, it's been with us since we gradually awoke it in childhood.
We can better appreciate the wonder of our self-awareness if we contrast it with something that doesn't have it. Animals. According to John Paul II, before God created Eve, Adam, the original man, felt original solitude. Even though he found himself in a garden bursting with life, he felt alone, even though he was surrounded by animals. Why did he feel this way? Because he couldn't fully relate to any of the animals. They were totally different from him in a most important respect. Father Norris Clark explains, although animals are aware through their senses of the outside world, they are locked into an extroverted focusing on the objects of their senses and cannot make that full return of the soul to itself, as St. Thomas puts it, which would enable them to be self-present as well as present to others. In a word, to be self-conscious. This truly is a wonder. Unlike animals, we're not lost in our external environment. Unlike animals, we can make that full return of the soul to itself, meaning that we can step back from our external environment and be present to ourselves as the ones knowing and acting. We can look at ourselves looking. We can say, I am looking. This is such a wonder that St. Thomas Aquinas and many thinkers after him used it as a powerful evidence to show that we are spiritual beings, for only spirit can be, as it were, in two places at the same time. In this case, both outside, me seeing, and inside, me being present to myself seeing. And the wonder grows, not only are we self-present or aware, but we are also responsible beings. In fact, it's because we're self-present, because we can say, I, that we are therefore responsible for our actions. Animals are not responsible for their actions. They don't act as eyes, but rather they respond to their environments through blind instincts and urges. They aren't free. We are, insofar as we act as persons. Moreover, we realize that our lives are moral dramas, meaning that we can and must choose to live either as persons or as animals, as men or as devils. Indeed, we can choose the type of person we will be through our actions. In a sense, Votiva Siet says, we can create ourselves, or as Clark puts it, by my actions, therefore, especially the repeated ones, I gradually construct an abiding moral portrait of myself, like an artist's self-portrait proclaiming implicitly, this is the kind of person I am.
Even God himself shows great respect for the moral drama that is the life of each human person. For instance, while he surely invites and calls us to follow him, he definitely doesn't force us. He doesn't treat us as objects, but as subjects. Of course, he has in mind the kind of person he wants us to be, but it's ultimately our choice whether or not we'll cooperate. Moreover, the moral law we're called to follow is not some arbitrary law imposed on us from outside. Rather, as we saw earlier, it is written on our hearts. So, God is not calling us to be something we're not. Rather, he's simply saying to us, as Father Clark puts it, be fully what you in fact are, or better yet, become fully what you already are, in the deepest and most authentic longing of your nature. He's inviting us to use our freedom to come back home, which is what following the natural law is really all about. It's our roadmap, because to our Creator and Father, showing us the way to complete the great circle of being. From a philosophical perspective, then, it's ultimately because of our moral responsibility, our ability to determine our course, to choose goodness itself, himself, that we should never treat others as mere objects. For each of us have a solemn task to become what we were created to be. It's a sacred calling that, as we saw, even God respects. John F. Crosby elaborates, persons are not just there, like rocks or plants. They are handed over to themselves. They are their own. As a result, they can make different things of themselves. They can accept or reject themselves. Above all, they can determine themselves in freedom. Indeed, in a certain sense, they can create themselves. If you try to use a person as a mere instrument, then you deprive that person of the space he needs for the uniquely person work of self-creation. If you are really going to respect persons, then we must step back from them, take our heavy hands off them, and let them be. That is, live as self-determining beings. In respecting them like this and in abstaining from all using, we treat persons as their own end.
The key word here is respect. We need to respect all human beings because of what they are, not mere objects, but subjects, not mere means, but ends, not its, but persons. As self-possessing beings, then, human persons have a dignity that we should recognize, honor, and regard with the deepest respect. Self-donation. While the key to the last section was the personalistic norm that a person should never be used as a mere object for use, the key to this section is that each person is utterly unrepeatable. Incommunicability, an infinitely interior subjectivity. But put differently, each person is a unique being of inexhaustible depth who should invoke our wonder and even love. For as the personalistic norm says in its positive form, the person is a good towards which the only proper and adequate attitude is love. In the last section, we saw that the human person is able to be self-conscious or self-present. And for this reason, he can be self-determining. He can, in a sense, create himself. This truly is a wonder. But we can only marvel at the infinite depth that this interiority entails. Newman calls it a depth within him unfathomable, an infinite abyss of existence. Father Clark calls the human person a known unknown, a mysterious abyss in which there's always more that's unknown than known, like a tip of an iceberg emerging above water. What accounts for this inner mystery? Well, first of all, Father Clark points out that there are vast depths of our unconscious that will always remain either unknown or only partially and indirectly accessible to consciousness. So just below the surface of our conscious life, there's a vibrant, hidden life that from time to time bubbles up to our conscious awareness indirectly through things like dreams or artistic expression. Because this hidden life is subconscious, we can't simply turn our attention to it, nor can we force it to show itself. So it remains a mysterious part of ourselves that we only glimpse from time to time. Yet even more profound and mysterious than this subconscious life is the spiritual dynamism at the core of our being. Father Clark describes it as follows.
There is the natural depth of the self, stemming from the fact that spiritual intellect and will we are naturally open to and have a natural drive towards the whole of being as both intelligible and good. Since this includes implicitly infinite being itself, there is a kind of infinite or inexhaustible depth in our spirit. Due to its openness to the infinite, which cannot be plumbed by our explicit consciousness, short of the direct vision of God Himself. When we shall see ourselves totally as God sees us, for example, as we really are, as the German mystical poet Angelus Silesius puts it, the abyss in man cries out to the abyss in God. Tell me, which is deeper? This is the most profound inner depth of our souls. This openness and drive for the infinite, this deep calling out to deep, from Psalms 42:8, is like a God-shaped hole in our hearts. For as beings made in the image of God, only God can fill our souls. St. Augustine expresses this idea in his famous prayer, "You made for yourselves, O God, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you." And so the human person, in his interiority, is an awe-inspiring wonder of infinite depth, because Father Clark meditated so deeply on this mystery. He felt such awe to an amazingly deep degree. Father Gately mentions in part two that Father Clark had an incredible sense of childlike wonder, even as a man well into his 80s. One example of his sense of wonder sticks out vividly in Father Gately's mind. Father Gately writes in his words, "I mentioned in part two that Father Clark had an incredible sense of childlike wonder, even as a man well into his 80s. One example of his sense of wonder sticks out vividly in my mind. It happened several years after I'd had this class in college. I was in the seminary at the time, and Father was scheduled to give a lecture at a local university, which I went to hear. On my way, as I neared the lecture hall, I noticed Father Clark approaching with Peter Kraft, who was one of my seminary professors that semester. I arrived at the main door before them and opened it to let them pass through first. I sort of hid behind the door, not wanting to disturb their conversation. As Father Clark was passing, though, he suddenly saw me, stopped, and cried out, 'Who are you?' A bit taken back by his surprise, I said, 'Well, Father, I had you for class several years ago. But you surely don't remember me. I sat at the back of the class and never said anything.' He said, 'Oh, yes, I clearly remember you. How are you?' he asked. The question was so much interest that I attempted to actually open up a bit. At the same time, I knew the lecture was scheduled to begin any minute, so I kept my answer short. But he kept asking me with sincere interest. So here was this distinguished philosopher, professor, and past president of the American Catholic Philosophical Association, keeping a packed auditorium of professors and graduate students waiting, simply to speak with a lowly seminarian. Of course, I was uncomfortable, but also deeply moved."
The next day, Father Gately writes that he had class with Peter Kraft, and I asked him about the incident. I said, "Dr. Kraft, when I was in Father Clark's class, I was just an undergraduate, and the class was for graduate students. I was intimidated by the other students and hardly said a word. How could he have remembered me?" Kraft replied, "It's because he loves much. Father Clark has a remarkable sense of wonder for each person, human person, and that's the source of his love. He doesn't forget the people he meets." I was blown away. The whole experience made me realize the incredible value of the philosophy of personalism. And so I studied it with even greater zeal, especially this connection between wonder and love. What follows is a summary of the fruit of those studies, which can be divided into two categories, reverence and empathy. Keep in mind that we're still within the general category of self-donation, also known as love.
Very powerful. And you know, something I just kind of want to throw out here that I'm really amazed with, and we're going to get into the questions here from the workbook in just a moment. But Julie and Mary Beth and I recorded this book. What was it, Mary Beth? Maybe 5 years ago?
Yes.
But sections got lost. Parts of our original recording were lost. And as we're recording, so we're re-recording this, Mary Beth and I, during this, you know, 2023 January, it's really hitting home how the Holy Spirit works and how this personalism I think is so much more relevant today than it was when we initially did this. So I feel very, very in awe how this section got misplaced in our recordings. You know, God's at work here. I really believe so.
For sure, Mary Graham. That's
our heads have been spinning. Where are these recordings? I don't know.
and God ordained that. He wants us to, especially you and me, and maybe in 2023, because as I was looking at, you know, the questions that we probably read on personalism, and maybe we need to read it, the things that are so just vividly screaming in our face right now that was not as apparent years ago. So
people have come, we'll get into the questions. I feel like in our society today, people have completely lost the sense of personalism, completely and totally. But now I'm curious, and I, as all things go, I don't know where my workbook is. So Mary Beth, can you please read our first workbook, workbook question? I believe it was on page 87, correct?
Sure, yes. So question number one, how has studying personalism helped you to deepen your appreciation of human dignity? In other words, what specific insights from the section on personalism gave you a deeper sense of wonder for the human person? I'll just jump in because as we were reading it, there were a couple negative things that were in my head, such as human trafficking and, of course, abortion. Although this year has had some monumental changes in the effort to, you know, with Roe versus Wade being
overturned,
but the just horrific nature of human trafficking that is apparent everywhere. But on the good side, I have been doing a study on Mother Teresa, and as I just read these words, just how she personified that, like just the human dignity of the person, in flesh. And I still, recently there was a movie, No Greater Love, I believe. It's put out by the Knights of Columbus, and it shows Mother Teresa's life and her sisters and their work. And you see John Paul II and her in definitely some footage, and the two of them just as soldiers side by side for that, you know, human dignity, that nobody was more important than the person in front of them, both of them.
Absolutely. And, you know, we all just kind of went through that crazy year of 2020. And you can't help but reminisce on all of the people who lost their lives at that time, and their loved ones were afraid to be at their side. So, and again, it's that dignity, as I was kind of pondering that as my dad had passed away. And we were in that boat where we were afraid because he had COVID, and it was early on, and we were afraid to go to his bedside. But it was so important that we needed to be there. And I was thinking about it actually just last week about how Mother Teresa wasn't afraid. She wasn't afraid to go to the bedside of those who were in need and hurting. And how many of us had that fear? I know I had it, you know, and, you know, it held me back for a couple of days. And at this point, we just need to ask ourselves for forgiveness and, you know, forgive ourselves for where we fell short during 2020 in serving our loved ones and those opportunities. And as we look forward, look for those opportunities because, you know, everything's kind of indicating that more drama is to come. Don't be afraid moving forward. Don't be afraid to just embrace whatever God puts before you.
Yeah, I think just knowing, like with Mother Teresa, how the Missionaries of Charity started, where it all was her going into the gutter, picking up one dying person, picking that person up. And, you know, while we might have situations in our personal life where we aren't quite up to that saint's, you know, but we're not there yet. It's like one step at a time, Mary. Our garden is right here where we're at. And it may not be these big things like Mother Teresa did that we're not ready for. But, you know, we can start anew every day with just being present to the person that's in front of us, which is so polar opposite of what is happening in our world that we're not present because of social media. We're just all over the place and don't have enough time to listen to someone. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. What's the next question in our book for today?
Question number two, how has studying the contemplative outlook help you to deepen your appreciation of human dignity? In other words, what specific insights from the section on the contemplative outlook gave you a deeper sense of wonder for the human person? At our parish at St. Raphael's in St. Petersburg, we have a monastorial type program called Catechesis of the Good Shepherd. And we certainly have catechists in our program that would be better apt to speak on this. But just simply put, I can be a spokesperson for that. It's that sense of wonder and love. You know, as we are mothers, we've raised our children. And you look back and you see, you know, when they were babies, that sense of discovery, that, you know, that's the way. And even as my kids have gotten older, not trying to tell them, letting them to discover and wonder is just such a beautiful way towards love. And that's what these catechists do in the children. A child may ask a question and the response of the catechist is, I wonder. And then they leave it at that. So maybe we'll have a little side podcast on the Catechesis of the Good Shepherd, because I think it really helps draw that into our youth. And obviously, as an adult, I need that.
Right. You know, what stood out to me as we were reading was the vibrant hidden life under our subconscious. I had never pondered that before, that there's something within us that we can't just bring it out and make it happen. It's like we can make our mouths work, we can make our minds work, but there's that inner being that we don't really have control over. I don't remember what page it was on in here, but it really struck me as, wow, how do you make that happen? Okay, Mary Beth, how do we bring that forward?
All I can do is wonder.
Exactly.
I think whatever you're seeking, if you're seeking God, he's going to weave in the answer. And so again, we're doing something called Calcutta 90 right now. We're spending 90 days with Mother Teresa and we're looking at the simple path. And in it, the very first, she has this like mantra of the fruit of silence is prayer. And the fruit of prayer is faith, et cetera, and goes on. You know, tapping into that, Mary, comes through silence and prayer. I know in the early morning hours and I'm opening up the word and there's no one awake, there are things that God brings to my consciousness of pondering, that heart pondering prayer that I had no idea was even inside of me. And he waits. He's a God of wonder and a God of surprise. And he longs to be with us and uncover these things. And when we're seeking and putting inside of us the good stuff, I mean, we're certainly not going to get it from eating Burger King. You know, if we're taking in, you know, movie after movie and Facebook and all, I mean, not that these things don't have its place, but if that's all we're taking in, that's what's going to be at our level of consciousness. And it can really stunt our growth towards closer union with God.
Personalism, I feel like so much of today, it's like you said with human trafficking earlier, people have lost that sense of personalism. They've kind of lost that sense of what it means to be a human being and a person compared to other things. You know, the thing too that we're seeing, I was having a conversation with a friend last night and she was talking about her nephew is feeling suicidal. And I think that's another big thing that kind of goes hand in hand with the human trafficking is so many of our youth, and it's hitting our youth hard, don't have that sense of personalism. They don't understand their purpose and their goal and their relationship to God and where it needs to be. And I think this is something that we really need to, you know, search our souls and ask how we can reach out to, they call them the Zillennials now, they're between the Generation Z and the Millennials. How can we reach out to them and help them kind of step away from their commercialism, which so many people are living at home and they've got jobs, they've got a huge expendable income and they're just living life big. And losing that sense of the person and the sense of service. So let's think about how we can reach out to the younger generation and embrace them and help them to have that encounter with not only themselves, but with God and with other people.
And our generation too. I mean, I'm finding it like sometimes we're on the phone doing the same things, if not more. You know, Mary, the word unrepeatable came up a couple times in the reading, and I've read a really good book. I know the author. It's called Unrepeatable, and it's written by Luke Burgess. I believe there's another author to it. Just fascinating book. But, you know, in nuts and bolts about our unrepeatable mission, each single person. And I work with the youth group, and that's often the words that are coming out of my mouth as I look at these kids and I go, don't you understand? You have an unrepeatable mission that only you can do. And to give God the greatest glory is a man fully alive, in the words of Saint Irenaeus. You know, and what does that mean? Like, how do we come to find what our unrepeatable mission is? You know, that God's got planned for us. Well, the enemy doesn't want us to find out that mission for sure. So
every choice you make is either bringing you closer to God's mission for your life or to the enemy's mission for your life. So always think, is this helping me to progress in holiness? Is this helping me to bring me closer to my ultimate goal of life in heaven with God someday? So great stuff. And thank you so much, Mary Beth, for joining us today. Thank you, everybody, who's sticking with us here as we work our way through this podcast. And we'll be back tomorrow with more as we continue reading The One Thing Is Three.